So hi, my name's Anna Marie Cox. I'm a senior political correspondent for MTV News. It's also, I covered the White House for a long time, and this is my first time in the White House as a sober person. So, it's less blurry than it used to be. I didn't realize, yeah. Also has fewer columns somehow. So let me introduce our panelists. Lindsay Greenkey. She founded Hope Soldiers as a nonprofit helping addicts to get into treatment in 2013. Thank you. And then Dr. Arthur Evans. He is the commissioner of Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Service. He has a faculty appointment at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and he's been especially active and innovative around issues of drug policy. And then we have Director Botticelli, Michael Botticelli, who is the first person in the position of drug czar to actually be in recovery, which is nice change of pace. And then we have, Veronica Amarante. Yes, I'm director of marketing and a certified addiction specialist. She has a story. She got into the music business at 18, loved it, was doing it for a long time, and then at 31, walked away because of issues out of addiction. But now she's back, and she's doing her service in the field of addiction recovery. And then the person on the end you may recognize, his name is Ben Haggerty, also known as Macklemore. He is a Grammy Award-winning artist and here to talk to us also about his journey in recovery. So thanks for being here. So I wanted to start out with some really basic stuff. The documentary kind of got us started in the conversation, but I think there are probably questions that some people might have that just are the very beginning of how to start dealing with the epidemic. And I think the first one I was curious about the panel's responses to is, what do you do if you have a friend who you think has a problem? So do you want to start, Lindsay?
Hi, guys. I mean, for me, I've been on both sides of this because I'm in recovery from addiction, as well as I have a lot of friends and family who are also either currently struggling or are in recovery from addiction. And the first initial conversation with somebody that you suspect is abusing or using drugs and alcohol, or has recently relapsed on drugs and alcohol, it's quite difficult. My best advice is to honestly just approach it with love and understanding and just say, look, I don't know what's going on. Feels like something's a little bit off. I'm not going to accuse you of anything. I'm not going to assume anything, but I just want you to know that if you are struggling right now, I'm here to help, and whatever you need, I'm here for you, pretty much. I mean, that's what I would do. It's just a really casual conversation. I think a lot of people feel like they have to put a lot of pressure on the situation to
have an intervention of some kind, right?
It doesn't need to be an intervention style conversation. It really doesn't. I mean, coming into it with grace and compassion and understanding opens the lines of communication.
Dr. Evans, you were in.
Maybe I should turn this
off.
That'll help.
Right. Hello. Okay. I love the answer, and I think the first thing is that we can't ignore the problem, because I think what tends to happen in families is that people tend to ignore or to minimize what can be obvious, and I think it's really important to break through that tendency. And I really agree with Lindsay. I don't think that highly confrontational approaches work. And, you know, you see some of these things popularized on television and those kinds of things. I do think that pulling people in is much better than trying to push people in. And I think that that's sort of the mindset that I think we have to have around this. The last thing I'll say about this is I do think it's important for people to have some basic understanding of what resources are available. So it's one thing to say, I think you need help. It's another thing to say, here's where you can get help. Mm-hmm. And often communities and family members don't know where people can get help. And so I think it's really important to educate ourselves about that.
And Director Botticelli, you probably can answer about how someone might find out where the resources are before you talk to your friend.
Sure. So one of the things I think that's helpful, and I think the panelists have talked about this, not only kind of treating people with kindness and compassion, but seek out professional help. That, you know, one of the biggest things that I hear from parents and others is that they don't know what behaviors or actions are helpful and what might be challenging or continue to enable the situation. So one, I would just encourage people to seek out professional help. You know, obviously meeting people with kindness and compassion is a really good place to start in terms of being able to do that. But the second thing, so there are a number of, I think, opportunities. SAMHSA has their treatment locator that so people are able to kind of click on it. Many states have treatment locators to be able to do that. But I also think this is where I think consulting a professional is really helpful, because they probably have a good idea of kind of what are kind of good, high-quality treatment programs that people can attend to. I think, you know, I think some of the work we have yet to do is that it's still too much by word of mouth, kind of what constitutes a highly effective treatment program that we have here. And we're making progress on that, but that's an area that I think we need to continue to focus on.
Right. I want to get to the next question, but also I'll add that I think it's also a good move if you can find someone who's in recovery to talk to your friend. You'll be surprised once you start asking around. It's an anonymous program sometimes, but people themselves are not anonymous. and they often want to be of service. And that's a good place, I think, in addition to professional help, in addition to just personal compassion, like bringing in someone who's been through the journey themselves, is an act of compassion. And I want to start at the next question on this end, because I know you two can speak to this personally, which is that, so let's say you have a friend who's just gotten out of treatment or just entered into the program of recovery. How would you, how does that person need to be treated? What's the advice for friends and family to how to treat this person upon them beginning their journey?
I think it's important to ask them what they need, because support looks different for everyone. As someone in recovery, for me, it's being available. It's bringing them to 12-step meetings. It's picking up the phone whenever they might need it. But I think, you know, how I can also look at this question is if, you know, their friend is still using. If you're a what we call a normie, someone that normally uses drugs or alcohol, and your friend gets out of treatment, how do you correspond with this person? And I think that each person is different. I'm around people all the time that drink alcohol. I probably don't want to be in a room full of a bunch of people smoking blunts. It's just not really my thing right now. So for me in early, but I got put right back into that world right when I got out of treatment for the first time. And it's never been a huge trigger for me to be around that. For some people it is. So it's important to have that conversation, and is this okay? Let's not make this weird. Let's put this out on the table and be honest about it. So us as friends know how to support you to the best of our ability.
Do you want to speak to that?
So one of the things that I think is really important that we all acknowledge is the shame that people feel when they become addicted. And you know, and that kind of ties back to your first question. It's just when we see someone struggling, I think we have to be very careful about the language that we use, about the way that we approach people. When someone gets out of treatment, I think that's just as important. Not everyone is successful when they complete treatment. We saw that in the documentary. We know that it may require multiple treatment episodes for someone to heal and to sustain long-term recovery. So I think it's really important that we provide support for those individuals like we would for any other chronic disease. If someone had a flare of diabetes or a relapse in cancer treatment or something happened, you know, would your attitude be different? You know, and I believe it is. So I think that shame is just something that lingers, you know, even for us still in long-term recovery, it's something that comes up. So as a friend, be sure to ask them what they need and just approach it with compassion and be very careful, you know, and just mindful of your approach and how you, in the language that you use, even when you're talking to other friends, because it's not just you and that person, but you guys might be a circle. And so you, everybody needs to be a part of their support network. And if you do still use certain substances and you don't have a substance use disorder, then I do recommend that you don't use around that person. It's just not fair to put them in that predicament. They may think they're ready to be around some substances, but maybe they're not. And people sometimes don't know that until they're faced with the situation. So I would just say, don't risk it, be supportive, and be mindful of the language that you use when you even refer to them and what they're going through.
Yeah, gossip and talking about someone who's been in treatment can be a real shame-producing thing. And I also want to add, people do ask, is it okay if I use? That's a frequent question I get. Is it okay if I use around my friend that's now sober? And I think it's true. It's not always triggering for people. You might want to err on the side of being respectful. Like, if someone just quit smoking, you probably wouldn't, like, light up around them, or you'd at least ask. And I know for me personally, and for my friends that have been through treatment, sometimes having people who just would, like, not go out, who don't need to go to bars, who might just stay at home and watch movies with you, or, like, play Scrabble, or just do something that wasn't, like, fueled by drugs and alcohol, that is a real, like, that's a real service. And you don't have to talk about the problem. You can just play Scrabble, you know, or, you know, whatever it is that kids play these days. Words with friends, but live. That's what Scrabble is, if you didn't know that. It's exactly like Words with Friends.
Can I just add to that?
Sure.
I think that, you know, it's, for me personally, and this is why asking them what they need
right.
is important, having, and that can change. Like,
right.
what they need on day three coming out of treatment might be very different in month three or year
yep.
three or whatever. But for me, I want to be treated as a human being. I don't want to be like, ooh, like, you know, we're trying to, you know, have some drinks tonight, but we're not going to invite him. To me, that is alienating. I want to feel a part of it. Now, it is up to me in my own recovery to take care of myself. And do I want, you know, people blowing smoke in my face? Absolutely not. But that can change. And I think that that's an evolving conversation amongst friends. Let's talk about this. Let's keep this out in the open.
Right. That's the thing. All of our journeys are a little bit different. So whatever advice we're giving actually always comes with that, which is actually the number one thing you need to do with whoever it is in your life that's going through this is talk to them. But let's also talk a little bit about family and friends of addicts and alcoholics. We saw Elena's mother in the documentary and her struggle. I'd like to go down the panel a little bit about talking about what kind of service can you offer, what kind of support should one offer to, you know, the loved ones of someone who's in addiction, either current addiction or in recovery.
One of the most difficult things about being a loved one of somebody that's struggling with addiction, especially how I've seen for parents, is how responsible they feel for their child's addiction or their loved one's addiction and how much they blame themselves. And like for me, I am a mother, but I'm not a mother of somebody that's old enough to use drugs or alcohol. And so it's difficult for me to provide the support that a mom with a child in recovery or in active addiction would need. And so I would refer them to a support group that specializes in that. And there's so many, I mean, there's so many Facebook groups, there's so many recovery groups for parents or loved ones of people in addiction, like Nar-Anon, Al-Anon, all of those types of programs. But the thing is like addiction is such a family disease that it really doesn't just affect the person that's struggling with the addiction, it really affects everybody around them. And so I think that it's really important for parents to get the same amount of treatment that the child or the loved one is getting, because we're all going to have to recover if you're in a kind of family dynamic, really.
Going back to a sick situation or just an unhealthy situation isn't going to be helpful. And usually it is a family dynamic and there are co-occurring illnesses. Dr. Evans, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. I agree with everything that Lindsay said. I think there are two ways to think about it. One is the support that people need, and family members often need support when they have a family member who is in active addiction. If for nothing else, for people to deal with the guilt that people mm-hmm. feel and the shame, because there's a lot of shame when people have family members who are addicted. And so I think getting the support around that is really important. But the other part is the treatment piece. And I don't think you can underestimate the treatment aspect. And I think there are two reasons why you want to be involved. And often, I will say the treatment field is culpable in this, is that we think about the person in isolation and that they need to go to rehab to get fixed. That's sort of the way we think about it. People live in family systems. They live in social systems. And if you use that analogy, if you fix the person and they come back to a system that is accustomed to a person who's not well, well, that system tries to get the person unwittingly back in the same situation that they were in, because people are used to daddy being drunk, because I know how to deal with daddy when he's drunk. I don't really know how to deal with daddy when he's not drunk, or mommy, or whoever it is. And so family systems can unwittingly undermine the person's recovery, but there's also the treatment that people need to go through themselves because they have gone through a lot in terms of managing and dealing with addiction.
Do you want to add to that?
So just a couple resources that I think are important. So we actually worked with the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids that actually has a great resource guide for parents and actually have created a network of parents who have gone through this that I think are really important to do. To Arthur's point, I think, you know, as we've talked about, how do we give good information to parents and family members about finding good treatment programs, it's one of the most essential questions that you should be asking, is to what extent are families, describe for me kind of how family and other loved ones are involved in this person's treatment. And I think that's a really fundamental question. And you know, it goes back to, I think, you know, determining a quality treatment program doesn't just treat the person, it treats the family and their loved ones. And that's gotta be an essential question to ask in determining.
You should be asking, is there a family weekend? Do you have family groups? I'm veteran of a few of those kinds of things. Go ahead. Do you want to?
Yeah. The place where I work, it's absolutely mandatory that the family participates. And I think the treatment industry is becoming the ethical providers, at least, are becoming highly aware of how important the family involvement is. Addiction is a very traumatic disease, not just for the person going through the addiction. These families are being traumatized by this disease. Not knowing if your child is going to be alive the next day is very traumatizing. Not knowing if your husband is going to wake up is very traumatizing. So as professionals, we acknowledge that these individuals also deserve care, treatment. It is just completely unrealistic to set someone up and send them back into the same family dynamic that perhaps may have facilitated some of this drug use or substance use to happen. So I think I'm hopeful that the rest of the treatment industry will catch up and provide family-specific services, and that there will be family-specific treatment centers because this is a family disease.
I believe there are some family-specific treatment centers. Ben, do you want to add anything to this? I want to add, so in addition to being in recovery myself, my husband's in recovery from opiate addiction. And for the first year that we were together, he was not sober. And I know that for me, like being the loved one, being the girlfriend specifically of someone who is dealing with disease, the thing that I can say that I needed, that I wanted, was for people not to tell me to leave him. Number one, that doesn't work. Stop loving that person that you're loving is not good advice. And also for people to stop giving me advice, that was also nothing really was helpful to hear from someone who wasn't going through it. The only thing that was really helpful was to hear from other people who were going through the exact same thing. Now, the people who, I had friends who, I'll say that my father, who's not, I call them earthlings, actually, people who can use drugs and alcohol normally. My father, I remember the most powerful thing he ever said to me was, I'm never going to tell you what to do. I'm just going to be here for you. I know you love him. I'm never going to get away with that. I'm just going to be here for you no matter what happens. It's a powerful thing to hear, especially someone who's in recovery myself, struggling with it. Move on a little bit. We have actually questions from the audience. I got a practical one I really appreciate. Two of us are student athletes heading to college. We have heard that they give us pain pills to stay in the game. How do we avoid this, even if we're on scholarship, especially since we're on scholarship? I'm gonna, Director Bocelli, do you have a?
So I think a couple things. One is It is on. So one is, I think just being informed patients, I think is really helpful. And while I do believe it's the prescriber's responsibility to do a good job at appropriate prescribing, I think we also have to make our aware of ourselves as consumers about appropriate pain management, so that we're able to quite honestly challenge physicians and other prescribers who may have not gotten their training yet on the CDC guidelines for appropriate training, or don't live in a state that mandate training for prescribers to do that. But I also believe, and I've said this as a person in recovery who's been prescribed opioids, that it's not my responsibility fundamentally to educate my prescriber on responsible prescribing. It's the prescriber's responsibility to do that. So, you know, again, I think we've spent a lot of time on working with states to pass mandatory prescriber education. As the president talked about, working with nursing schools, with medical schools, with dental schools, to integrate those guidelines into part of the curricula. I think we have actually paid special attention to the phenomena of athletes and prescribing. So how do we continue to work with both collegiate and high school sports medicine folks and coaches to make sure that we are not prescribing pain medication as a first-line pain defense, if that's not what people need, just to keep them in the game.
My understanding is that, I mean, it's true that the field of pain management has gotten a lot better, that it's now more holistic, and that's what people should be asking for too as well, right? Like, now you're not just going to treat my shoulder, you're also going to help me with weights, and I'm going to, like, get a full treatment plan. It's not just give me a bottle of pills and I'll walk out the door.
That's what actually the guideline support is, you know, non-opioid pain prescribing, looking at other alternatives like acupuncture or physical therapy or massage as part. We don't want people to be their pain not be treated, but what we want to do is to really make sure that we are looking at every alternative besides opioid pain prescribing unless they're absolutely necessary.
Can I add to that? I think that as someone in recovery, it's easy to get a prescription from a doctor, and I completely agree. It's not the patient's responsibility at all to educate the doctor on the medication, but it is my responsibility as an addict in recovery to be honest about my disease. And that is where I've relapsed in the past is that, you know, the minute that a doctor is like, oh, you're in pain, okay, I'm going to write you this and this and this, all of a sudden, like, my addict mind, I can have years of sobriety, and my addict mind is like, yes, perfect. And there I am 2 days later, like at the drug dealer's house, and I've taken all of the pain medication or whatever medication it is that they've given me. So it's, you know, it's taken me years and years of relapsing to realize, like, okay, if you are going to get this, for one, this goes immediately to someone that you trust that can delegate pain management, because it's not you. The minute that I get any taste of any sort of mind-altering substance, I want more of it. So being honest in the first place, if you can, don't get that medication if you are an addict, because those receptors are just going to pop off. And if you absolutely need it, give it to someone that can help you with management that you trust.
Can I fundamentally agree that my recovery is my responsibility. But part of it is we can't let the medical community off the hook by fundamentally not asking people about their history of substance use, not being familiar with what recovery means, and not doing their due diligence. And, you know, I think the president was being very kind when he said that the medical community needs to lean into this a lot more.
Right.
So part of it, Ben, is I'm trying to make a point that, you know, the medical community has a role to play, and they need to do, you know, we need to educate them about addiction in general and about prescribing. So
I completely agree. I've never been asked by a doctor if I have an issue with addiction, like never. Wow. And I've been, you know, from years of actual pain and then actual like bullshit pain where I'm just at the doctor, like I have literally never been asked by a doctor if I, and it can just be that asking that you're like, you know what, I should be honest right now. Cause I'm always on the line. I'm like, should I say it? Should I not? Okay. I'm just going to be quiet and leave with a bottle of pills.
Yeah.
That is so real. That is so real. I mean, we have to hold ourselves accountable and we do have to be engaged patients, you know, whether it comes to pain management or any other condition. But just to touch on this really quickly, colleges were previously viewed as recovery hostile environments. And for anyone headed to college, I just want to put it out there that there are now collegiate recovery communities and collegiate recovery programs. Yes, we have the George Washington University Collegiate Recovery Program in the house. There's support. And if you find yourself struggling, just know that if you're on a university campus, there's someone there that has been through what you've been through. So just reach out.
There's lots of schools that have like sober dorms, yeah. Sober hangouts, all that kind
exactly.
of stuff. Yeah. It is true. Also, this we didn't touch on this when we were talking about what to do with friends who are in recovery. Like we in recovery can't use any mind altering substance safely. Any. There's no like, it's just a beer here, you know, like there's no like, oh, just going to have a toke, like whatever. People say toke. I'm old. Hit. Thank you. And also, like, I know I'm in recovery because I'm, like, probably on this stage, I know I'm not the only person on the stage that looks forward to a colonoscopy, like, because you get a drip, man. It's a free lapse, we call it.
Also very real.
Super real.
Also getting my teeth pulled, like, I'm really into it. sorry. Surprised you haven't heard that one. Anyway, so we have another question from the audience. Moving on to a little more serious here. So what can we say to an addict that doesn't want to go to treatment because they don't feel comfortable speaking to therapists and strangers? Are there other options for recovery that begin without therapy or could help someone feel more comfortable? Anyone want to take that?
I'll take that. Well, the first thing is that I think that there are multiple pathways to recovery, and there's no one way that people get into recovery. And in fact, we talk a lot about treatment, but there are many, many people who have even opiate addictions who don't get in recovery through regular treatment. They go to a church, or they go to a masjid, or they go through some other non-pharmacological or community-based resource. And, you know, even as a treatment professional, I think we have to be open to that. There are many people. One of the first things I did when I finished school was I was the clinical director for a medical detox. And I know how difficult opiate addiction can be. But I can tell you there were people who came to detox over and over and over again. And it wasn't until they got into a church that they were able to maintain their sobriety. And so I think we have to be open to multiple pathways for people. Different things work for people. And if people are not comfortable talking, that's okay. In really good treatment programs, it's okay to sit there and not say anything. People mm-hmm. aren't forced to speak in a really good treatment program. And so I think people just need to be open to those different pathways.
Right. I'm going to touch on that just a little bit, just because I work with so many people who that question comes up or that situation comes up. For myself, I am totally fine being social and personable with people, but I do not like to share my feelings and my intimate thoughts with hardly anybody. I really struggle with it. I mean, even still to this day. And so for somebody who is already ashamed and embarrassed and guilty for the things that they feel that they've done and the mistakes they feel that they've made, it's pretty understandable for them to kind of be wary about wanting to open up to a complete stranger. I mean, for me, when I first went to treatment, I think I talked about everything except for what the issues were for me. And that's why I had to go to treatment again. But when I went the second time, the part that took place in me was the surrender and the willingness. I allowed myself to be open about what was really wrong with me, because I knew that it wasn't just that I was using drugs, because substance abuse is really only a symptom of the disease. It goes so much more deep than that. For me, it was like an identity crisis. I didn't know who I was, why I'm here, or anything like that. And I know so many people struggle with that. And I had co-occurring mental health issues as well. I started out as a cutter, actually. So when I have somebody tell me, like, I don't want to go to treatment because I'm afraid that I'm going to have to open up to somebody about the way that I feel, I'm like, I'm with you. I totally understand that. Are you willing to try? You know, are you willing to just go and give it a shot, allow other people around you in the group setting to open up and kind of create that comfort level so that you can know that it's okay, that you're not the only one? Because I think people really feel like they are the only ones, and they're not. I mean, there's just so many people out there that are just like you and me. So I think that just encouragement, that not pressure, but like really encouraging people. And like he was saying, like, there are so many options. Like, you don't have to go to a traditional treatment center where it's like you have a counselor and you have a group and you have a this. There's like wilderness treatment centers that people go to. I have somebody that went there and she's doing amazing. There's so many different options out there. I think it's really important to emphasize how encouraging people to be willing is important.
And Ben, I sort of am curious about your perspective on this as someone who deals with the celebrity aspect of being in recovery and maybe having some issues that having thought I don't want to share. Like, how do you deal with that?
Share my experience.
Yeah. Did you have any hangups about, you know, like, I don't need to do this because I'm obviously you got into recovery, so you're over that. But like, what was it like for you to make the decision that I'm going to be open about this? Even though I'm someone in the public eye.
Yeah, I think, well, when I got sober for the first time, I wasn't in the public eye. I was very much a broke rapper living in my parents' house. But when even then, like, I was still making music, and amongst my community, I had a name locally. And amongst my community, I had to make the decision, like, how do I address this? I've always been honest in my music up until this point. Do I continue this honesty? And it took me a minute to figure it out. And I just am the kind of person that's like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go fully there. So let's be truly transparent about it. Because at the end of all of this, it's comes back down to service. That's what keeps me sober. It's something that I think probably everyone that struggles with addiction hears about if they go to a meeting or if they go into treatment. It's we get sober so we can pass it on to somebody else. You know, we help ourselves and then we help other people because that helps us. I mean, Lindsay embodies that. She dedicates her life to helping other people. And as much as that is for the community and for the true nature of service, it also helps Lindsay stay sober, I imagine. It helps me stay sober. It gets me out of my own selfish nature of thinking about me. So not only do I make music for the therapeutical aspect of it about recovery, but I also make it to pass along a message that's so much bigger than me. This is about a community of people trying to get better together, and that's how the message is passed on.
Okay. You know, I think it's important a couple things. One, to acknowledge that, you know, there is not a bright line between using and recovery. That it's really a stage of change, right? So all of us could probably think back and say there was a whole host of things that happened before I was willing to you know, finally be done, and maybe not finally be done, and that took time. But I also think one of the things that's really important, particularly in this epidemic, particularly in light of the overdoses, and particularly in light of viral hepatitis and HIV, that we continue to engage with folks, that in the meantime, we make sure that people have access to sterile syringes, that we make sure that people get naloxone. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do, even get, you know, before people are ready to make that commitment. You know, we really have to kind of, just like you did in the film, you need to engage with people, meet them where they're at, tell them that they're worth dignity and care, and make sure we're keeping them alive and that we're keeping them free from getting infectious disease, you know, while hopefully they will want to get treatment one day.
And actually, I'm glad you brought up naloxone, because I wanted to mention it again for people that may want to know what they can do in their communities, is that it's relatively, most states, how many states offer Narcan over the counter now? A ton. Look it up. Almost all of them. Almost all of them. And Narcan is the overdose antidote. What?
I think it's about 30.
Yeah. It's the overdose antidote. And if you have people in your community that are active users, you can get an over-the-counter prescription for it, either injection or nasally delivered, and you can have it on hand.
And
auto-injected, yeah. And it's something that it's not pleasant to think about sometimes, but if you have someone who's really struggling and you think that there is a chance that they might overdose in or around you, you can have that on hand. And it's not going to give them permission to use, because trust me, they're going to use anyway.
Can I just add something? And we're so grateful to this administration for all the work they've done to get this life-saving drug into people's hands and first responders. And to have these prescriptions available for families of people who use, you know, opiates. But it's really important that they still contact first responders.
Yes.
Because once they do receive the drug and they do wake up, there could be some side effects. So it's really important that if families do have access to this prescription, that they engage medical professionals right away.
Since you just mentioned that, the Good Samaritan law, it is a federal law. If you witness somebody who is overdosing on drugs or alcohol and you happen to also be under the influence, you are protected by law to not be prosecuted or charged with a crime if you call and report that that person needs medical attention.
Yeah.
That's really super important for people to know, because in my county, there was just a woman, 30 years old, that was charged for leaving a man to die from an overdose in a car, and she's facing homicide charges from $20 worth of heroin. Mm. This is really serious. So it's really important to know that anybody that witnesses it that is also under the influence is not going to be in trouble when they report it, because you're saving a life.
Right. So I want to actually, we have to start to wrap things up, but I want to get to something that we've sort of been dancing around a little bit or engaging with, which is like the stigma around addiction, what we can do individually to help solve that. I guess I want to go to Veronica first, because you're the social media outreach director, right?
I'm director of marketing.
Director of marketing.
I did do social media in the past.
But because I'm really curious, because I know that that's been, you know, social media has been used really successfully to destigmatize other kinds of issues, suicide prevention, the It Gets Better campaign. What's going on there?
I'm happy to report that we have a very active recovery community. There is, you know, a recovery advocacy movement, and we have thousands of people that every day spend so many hours, you know, advocating for access to treatment, access to recovery support services. And this community is alive and well on social media. You can visit youngpeopleinrecovery.org for more information on how to get involved. But as far as social media is concerned, I think a lot more people are being open about their recovery, and that needs to happen. And it's very difficult. I mean, it's not as easy as ever, you know, for everyone. And I am so grateful to you for stepping out and having so much courage in that industry to just say, I'm a rapper and I'm clean. Like, the hip hop has been so, it's a drug use culture, you know, to a degree. And I know for me, when I was in the music industry, I didn't reach out for help because I didn't want to be a stereotype. You know, I didn't want to be, you know, I wasn't an entertainer. I was in the business side, but there was just so much shame and stigma, and shame and stigma prevents people from getting help. I never went to treatment because I was too afraid to ask for help. And knowing what I know today, I could have died. And to be perfectly honest, I talk about my recovery to some people. I talk about it in professional circles. I talk about it, you know, to people in the recovery community. But this is the first time I've talked about my recovery in a public forum. This is the first time that some of my family members will know that I'm in recovery. Because not only, you know, is it the shame and stigma about what people, you know, in here in America will think, but I'm also a minority. And we have huge barriers when it comes to shame and stigma. And unfortunately, our cultures are very private. We don't discuss our problems. We don't have mental health issues. We also get shamed if we do. You know, in the African American community, we get called crackheads, mm-hmm. Even if we don't smoke crack. So it's very difficult, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that there's different populations that are suffering from this disease that have a bigger burden and have more barriers to treatment and to acceptance and to support. And I think we all just have to realize that this is a collective experience that we're going through as a nation, and it needs to be, we need to participate, all of us, individually, in this collective healing experience and collective recovery, because just SAMHSA just released that report about 2 weeks ago saying that in 2015, more Americans use opioids than all tobacco products combined. Like, marinate on that for a sec. That means that more people took painkillers than they smoked cigarettes, chewed tobacco, or smoked cigars in 2015. Like, this is huge, you guys. If we don't really get with the program and start being supportive and erase the shame and the stigma and start having honest conversations with our loved ones, because this is affecting everyone, we're not gonna win this. So I just really hope that, you know, those barriers are removed sooner than later.
We have to wrap up, but yes. But something to add?
Great comments. You know, I think that this is probably the biggest problem that we have. You know, I think treatment works, and we know how to treat people, and we're pretty successful. I think the biggest challenge we have in our field right now is how do we reduce the stigma so that people will get the help that they need when they need it. In Philadelphia, we're doing a whole variety of things to try to do that. We're doing everything from arts programs where we're getting communities to come together to paint murals and with people who are actively addicted because it changes their perception of who I thought a person who was addicted looks like. Storytelling events where people tell their story. I think one of the most powerful things that we can do as a field, and you see it starting to change, I think, public perception. It's what you've done, it's what Macklemore, what all the people on the stage have done. That is to put a face on recovery. Because people in our communities have a clear idea of what an addicted face looks like. They don't have the image that your face is the face of a person in recovery. And I think that that's so important in Philadelphia. We're talking about the recovery walk that we had in Philadelphia. The first recovery walk in Philadelphia had 127 people. This year we had 26,000 people at our recovery walk. And those were almost probably over half of that group were people who were in recovery, who were standing up saying recovery is possible. And then for people who are not in recovery, they were saying, you know what, we stand with you. It's a very powerful message. And I think we have to do as much as we can to put a positive face on recovery. For people to be willing to tell their stories. You know, I disclosed recently that, you know, I come from a family that has a lot of addiction in it. You know, I can go back generations. And living in that context, that becomes normal. Mm. You start to believe that all families are like that. And the reality is that most families do have addiction in them, but it's also the reality that that's not normal and that people can get in recovery. So I think those are important things for us to keep in mind as we're trying to get more treatment. Let's do what we can to reduce social stigma.
Right. I'm going to wrap up. We're going to end on what you have to say. Hold on. Okay. Before we go, I want to do two things, which is to say that unfortunately, the Good Samaritan law is a state law, not a federal law, but it is at many state levels. The other thing I want to do is thank the White House for having us here. Drawing attention to this issue. I want to thank the directors, the producers of the documentary, Craig, Amelia, Erica, and the rest of the Punched in the Head team. I want to thank the audience for their great questions, and I want to end on the highest note possible.
So I did want you guys to know that throughout this experience, there is still so much hope, and Elena actually has over 90 days clean. So.
Last thing, website people should go to, hhs.gov/, do you know Dr. Bocelli? Opioids. hhs.gov/opioids. Thank you, guys. Thank you.